On this Mother's Day, I would like to invite us to reflect about mothering, not only in the vitally important biological sense, but also in the larger sense that Carol began to speak about in the spoken meditation of giving birth, of caring for, of nurturing a legacy, a person, an institution that continues to live beyond us. Along these lines, last year on Mother's Day, some of you will recall, we explored the life of Margaret Fuller, who was grouped with Emerson and Thoreau as the Transcendentalist Big Three, and is the author in 1845 of the first significant work to take the liberal side in the question of women's rights since the days of Mary Wollstonecraft, which was 50 years prior. In future years, I look forward to telling you about other founding mothers of our faith, such as Mary Moody Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's highly influential aunt, who he called my earliest and best teacher, Judith Sargent Murray, an early American advocate for women's rights and the wife of John Murray, who was the founder of Universalism in the U.S., Olympia Brown, who in 1863 became the first woman to be ordained with full denominational recognition. Sophia Lyon Foss, who revolutionized UU religious education in the 20th century. There are so many founding mothers of our faith whose stories I look forward to sharing with you. Now, here at the beginning, allow me to pause, because that's already a lot of names and dates and details. Allow me to pause and say that my point this morning is not to overwhelm you with names and dates. Rather, my hope is that your takeaway will be that as Unitarian Universalists in the early 21st century, we stand on the shoulders of giants, many of whom were path-breaking women. And to me, it's vitally important to tell and to retell these stories so that we might increasingly inscribe them into our sense of ourselves, allowing them to inspire us to live more boldly and compassionately in the days ahead, that future generations might live more freely, more nobly, because of the world that we have helped shape. I'll turn now in particular to the Peabody sisters who helped shape the world we have inherited. I'll concentrate principally on the oldest and longest living of the Peabody sisters, Elizabeth Palmer Peabody. Laura mentioned some about her in our story for all ages. Elizabeth was born in 1804. She died in 1894. So her life sort of stretched almost the whole of the 19th century. But it's perhaps appropriate on this Mother's Day to begin not with Elizabeth, but with the Peabody sisters' own mother, Eliza, who strongly influenced her daughters. And whereas the lives of her daughters, again, spanned almost all of the 1800s, Eliza came of age in the 1780s, in the wake of the American War for Independence. And similar to Rosie the Riveter, that archetypal poster that we think of sometimes of women who discovered they were more capable than was previously granted as they took jobs formerly reserved for men while the men were fighting World War II overseas, a similar dynamic, less acknowledged, also happened during the Revolutionary War. So for some daughters of the independence, so to speak, girls who, like Eliza, grew up as the children or the sisters of soldiers, they helped run the farms and the businesses while the men were of the family fought the war. And power after the war at home was never quite enough for many of these women. Indeed, we have a letter that Eliza wrote to one of her daughters in which she laments having to wear petticoats and being limited to the domestic sphere. She writes of her aspirations to pursue a position of power, that her dreams that she wishes she could become governor. So she really didn't set her sights low, right? Like to be governor, alderman, or judge, even serve on a jury, which she was not allowed to do, to be a senator, to be a representative. But society did not yet allow women to shatter those glass ceilings. Nevertheless, in an age when women were pressured to see marrying well as their highest possible aspiration, and were often taught that knowing how to sew a shirt and to bake a pudding was their best kind of route to their equality MRS degree, right? Eliza, in that world, helped give her daughters as good an education as most college men and brought them up to be able to support themselves irrespective of whether they chose to marry. Elizabeth, her mother's namesake and the most independently minded as well as publicly successful of the three sisters, Elizabeth never married. There's actually intrigue that I won't get into, sort of her sisters, who they did marry. Those men were kind of came to suit Elizabeth. They came as suitors for Elizabeth, ended up marrying her sisters. It's a long story. And you can see Eliza's vision, though, for all her daughters as early as her choices to name them after an English queen, Elizabeth, the Holy Mother, Mary, and the Greek word for wisdom, Sophia. So you can think about the word philosophy, right? Philia, Sophia, love of wisdom. Eliza Peabody was also an example for her daughters. So according to family lore, Eliza read through the entire set of her family's collection of Shakespeare folios when she was only four. Now, it doesn't say whether she comprehended them, but that's still a lot to read. And I'll get into whether she may have had some comprehension, because it's almost like some of the stories you hear about her are sort of like what you hear about the child Mozart, that these sort of really remarkable people who are extremely gifted in a certain area who do these really remarkable things at really early ages, these prodigies. And so seeking to pass on her love of learning to her daughters, when there was no college for women in the United States for another half century at that time, Eliza innovated where she could as a school teacher herself, structuring her classroom, and Laura taught some about this, as a stimulating mix of dramatic readings, of lively conversation, of inventive writing exercises, including she was sure to... especially sure to pick out readings by all the female intellectuals she could find. The result was that the schools run by Eliza and later by her daughters were in many ways superior to the more rigid traditional models that were open to boys and men at the time. More broadly, many of the most important curriculum innovations in the 19th century were the products of women educators, who were free to experiment with their schools for girls. It was the boys' schools, both public and private. There were no Montessori schools at this time in the U.S., so it was the girls' schools, both the boys' schools, public and private. They emphasized rote learning. So it wasn't this sort of interactive, dynamic, lively classroom that Eliza Peabody and later her daughters ran. The boys' schools were about rote learning, competition for class rank, and corporal punishment was largely unquestioned. Thanks to the Peabodys and other path-breaking educators, we have a much more progressive and humane education system in this country today, even if we still have a long way to go. And to begin to bring some of the web of connections, so this spring we've had about once a month we've looked at a different UU figure, so William Miller Lee Channing, Joseph Priestley, Theodore Parker. So to look at some of the web of connections to some of these Unitarian figures we've explored in recent months, the Peabody's family physician and friend was Dr. Walter Channing, who, as many of you can guess, was the brother of that celebrated Unitarian minister, William Ellery Channing, who in 1819 preached the sermon Unitarian Christianity, which is where we get the name Unitarian from. And we named our chapel, Channing Chapel, after him. Elizabeth first heard Ellery Channing preach in 1811 when she was only seven, and from that very young age, she was just enraptured with his presence and his way of being and his care for children. And as a result of Elizabeth's exposure to this increasingly liberal theology of Channing and other similar ministers who in the next decade would come to fully embrace a Unitarian position, Elizabeth also often found herself, even as this really young child, in these fairly heated theological arguments, both with other children and both with adults. But she refused to give in to the pressure of both children and other adults to accept the sort of prevailing Calvinist theology of the day, you know, that humans are totally depraved, that some people are, you know, doomed to eternal torment, that, you know, you have to believe in the Trinity, you have to believe Jesus was divine. She just wasn't buying that. Instead, at age 10 or 11, she found herself insisting to children and adults around her that we all have the same freedom and capacity to be good that Jesus showed was possible in his own human life. And when her aunt tried to bribe her, she said, "Elizabeth, I will give you a piano and music lessons." And this was kind of a rare, really special thing that she was offering Elizabeth. She said, "I will give you piano and music lessons if you will promise to read only Calvinist books and study them." And Elizabeth really had to think about it. It was a real temptation. But she ultimately, in resisting, found that her resolve was only strengthened to pursue the search for truth without any sort of restraint or censorship. And as she read the writings of some of our Unitarian forebears coming out of Europe, she found what myself and many other students of UU history have found, that our thoughts and our inclinations are affirmed and strengthened and clarified and found to be rooted in quite an ancient tradition. Indeed, all on her own, and by the age of 13, Elizabeth had followed a good portion of the course of study that Channing recommended for his graduate students in divinity at Harvard. Around this time, Elizabeth's parents made at least one last-ditch effort to curb her increasingly liberal theology. They said she should choose for herself, that she could choose for herself what she would read for the future if she would read only the Bible for an entire summer. And she had to set aside all commentaries, particularly, they said, Socinian ones. So if you think of Socinian, Faustus Socinus he lived in Europe in the 1500s, and he became very known for popularly espousing that Jesus was fully human and not divine. So that was kind of contrasted. Even like Channing, for example, was what is known as an Arian Christian. So going back to the 4th century with the Emperor Constantine at the Council of Nicaea, that was Arius versus Athanasius. And Athanasius is the one that said, you know, Jesus is fully divine, part of the Trinity, pre-existent. Arius actually did not say Jesus was fully human. Most people misunderstand that. Arius just said Jesus was created by the Father God and was a little less than God. It really was kind of later that Socinus in the 1500s, as part of the Radical Reformation, picked up on that. So at this point, as a 13-year-old, Elizabeth is reading much more radical stuff than even like Channing was comfortable with. It would have been stuff that like Parker and the next generation, Theodore Parker, would have been comfortable with. So they said, you have to read just the Bible, and you can't read any Socinian commentaries on the Bible while you're reading it. That was the deal. And then if that doesn't convince you, you're gone. We're just, whatever. You know, not kick her out, but we give up. And so at age 13, Elizabeth proceeded to read the entire New Testament through 30 times in 3 months. And each of those 30 times she read through, she read attentively to a different doctrine. So she'd read through once, paying attention to what does it say about the divinity of Christ? One time, what does it say about the end times? One time, what does it say about salvation? What does it say about the Holy Spirit? What does it say about sin? So she would pay attention to different elements each time, these different disputed points of doctrine. This is what you're all going to do on your summer vacations, right? But contrary to her parents' hope, Elizabeth emerged even more firmly convinced that the distinctive doctrines of orthodoxy, so remember orthodoxy means straightening, right? Ortho, like your orthodontist, doxy, like your praise, it means putting braces on your words about God, right? To make sure they're straightened out. That the distinctive doctrines of orthodoxy were corruptions of the true Christianity. And this is really the reason that these classes I've been teaching at Frederick Community College and at the Frederick School of Religion, I've been calling them banned questions about the Bible. And that's really because all I'm doing is sort of pointing out the things that Elizabeth discovered, that it's actually almost like the worst thing you could do to get someone to prove orthodoxy is to tell them to actually read the Bible in its entirety for themselves. What you want to do is to tell them to read only the certain portions that have been cherry-picked for orthodoxy. Because you read the whole Bible, it's very clear. It is an anthology, and it's got lots of great stuff and lots of weird and kooky stuff and lots of competing voices. You know, what Paul says versus what James says, that John is very different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so as she read through the Bible for herself, she was like, oh yeah, no, I'm right. This is really much more complicated than what you were telling me. So that fall, a family friend, who unlike her immediate family, was really impressed with Elizabeth's learning, invited her to visit her home in Boston for 6 weeks, so that each Sunday Elizabeth could hear Channing preach in his home pulpit. So she'd just heard him once as a 7-year-old, so now she was invited to go to Boston. And Channing preached it was at that point the Federal Street Church. It's now moved. So if you go to Boston today, you can visit the congregation that used to be Channing's. It's known as the Arlington Street Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Boston. And in addition to meeting with Channing in person, what was even more influential on Elizabeth was sitting in on Channing's facilitation of the Women's Gospel Discussion Group. So as she sat in on that, she found Channing to be this really gentle, encouraging presence for the women. But she found the women, she was really horrified that most of the women just sat there in silence and had nothing to say or really kind of struggled to articulate any sort of original opinion. So this dynamic was deeply disturbing and influential for the 13-year-old Elizabeth Peabody. She left vowing to be different herself and to help other women learn to speak their minds, as she already felt able to do at 13 years old. And in 1820, I'm sure you've met some 13-year-olds or were 13-year-olds like this, but... And in 1822, at age 18, Elizabeth did boldly move to Boston by herself. And when she sought out a Greek tutor to continue the Greek education that her father had begun with her, and to continue augmenting her education, she ended up, as she just solicited any Greek tutor, she ended up meeting with none other than the 19-year-old recent Harvard graduate, Ralph Waldo Emerson, was her Greek tutor. And that was when Emerson finished Harvard undergrad, not Harvard Divinity School, which is going to come later. She so impressed Emerson that when she eventually, when they kind of finished the Greek tutoring relationship and sent for the bill, a message was sent back to her in return that he had no bill to render, for he found he could teach me nothing. Continuing the web of connections, when Elizabeth was a schoolteacher for a while in Maine, her employer, who invited her to be the only member of their town's sort of metaphysical discussion group, similar to like the Transcendentalist Club, it turned out that he had studied as a boy with Joseph Priestley. So that we talked about before, that minister scientist who discovered oxygen, who inspired Jefferson to create the Jefferson Bible, so that was sort of this line of influence there with Joseph Priestley. But I don't mean to give the impression that Elizabeth only found encouragement along the way. To give you just one example of the sexism that she had to overcome, the president of Harvard, whom she had encountered socially and who had encouraged her in the past, he also wrote her a letter at one point, you know, trying to, as you kind of see this, if any of you watch Mad Men, you see the sort of men trying to give the women well-intended advice, but it's extremely like patronizing and patriarchal and talking down to them. So he wrote her a letter, which he intended to be helpful, but he was telling her, you know, Elizabeth, you're really at the risk of becoming so smart that you're going to be unattractive to any men who want to marry you. Elizabeth, however, pressed on, and in 1825, almost a decade after first hearing Channing preach in his own pulpit, she began making the weekly trips again on Sunday to hear him. And we have records that she, and this is again where you get to, did she maybe understand some of that Shakespeare at age 4? That she listened so closely to his sermons that with her powerful memory, she would go home and write them down almost verbatim. And these were not my, like, 20-minute, 2,000-word sermons. These were significantly longer. So she really was an impressive, sort of gifted person. Over time, she connected with Channing and began visiting with him on Saturday afternoon. So at a time when Emerson at this point had gone back to Harvard Divinity School for his master's degree, so at a time when Emerson and other soon-to-be Unitarian ministers were students at Harvard Divinity School, following this reading list drawn up by Channing, listening to the eminent minister's sermons from the pew, it was Elizabeth who was being regularly personally mentored by Channing and was dialoguing with him as he talked through the ideas that at the time he felt were too radical to share with his congregation in sermons. So he was dialoguing with her and working through those ideas. For a time, Elizabeth became extremely close to the whole Channing family. She would come home from school with their daughter. She would eat supper with the family and take dictation. And she was Channing's what is called amanuensis, so she would take dictation for him and copy manuscripts for him, often until late in the evening. In the summer of 1828, she spent a month on vacation with the family. Now, she had quite a good experience later when her sister Mary did that. It did not go so well. They sort of just saw Mary as the hired help, and that's a whole other story. It also gets into these things about, like, sort of how Channing and others saw themselves, or, like, Emerson saw himself as this, you know, male, rugged individualist. But then when you look at all the stuff that, like, his wife did for him and that his daughters did for him that made possible him to write these essays about rugged individualism. Anyway. Or like Thoreau, you know, writing about Walden, but he's living on Emerson's land, right, and having dinner with Emerson. And anyway, these things are more complicated than are often granted. But Elizabeth did not take these opportunities given to her for granted. She did not forget her vow to pay it forward and to encourage other women to be bold and engage in pursuing their self-fulfillment. She started hosting, in particular, weekly conversations with women where she could encourage them to think their own thoughts. Elizabeth also became deeply involved, as Laura mentioned, with Bronson Alcott's Temple School for Children. And although it only lasted 3 years and Alcott never paid her much, he did not pay Margaret Fuller much either, who was Peabody's successor. Their breakthrough methods at the school of cultivating each student's innate gifts, that would become really a hallmark of progressive education in America for the next two centuries. Indeed, many of you will know the name of Bronson Alcott's second daughter, Louisa May Alcott. She wrote a book some of you may have read called Little Women. And the next daughter after Louisa May, born to Bronson and his wife, that next daughter, who was the basis of the character Beth in the novel, was named Elizabeth Peabody Alcott in honor of Bronson's friend and colleague, Elizabeth Peabody. Though I should add that when Elizabeth left the school, probably because he wasn't paying her very much and because he was making some unwise, controversial decisions, a disgruntled Bronson changed the daughter's middle name to Sewell. So he was probably too late to change Elizabeth, but he did change Sewell because he was mad at her. She, unlike him, did not hold a grudge and continued supporting him even as he made bad decisions. So last week we talked, in looking about this musical Pippin, we talked about finding your corner of the sky. And as Elizabeth sort of discerned her vocation and calling, having all these experiences, eventually in 1840, in her mid-30s, she drew on all her experiences and her connections up to that point and discerned that what she really wanted to do, the sort of different things she could do, was to open a bookstore and a circulating library specializing in books and journals imported from Europe that were really hard to find in the U.S. in the early pre-Civil War period. All the texts that brought transcendentalism into being, that fed it still, and yet were so expensive and hard to find, she wanted to make those easily accessible in Boston in a bookstore. But keep in mind, at this time, with what she's kind of taking a leap and risking doing, there were no bookstores specializing in foreign books, and there were no female bookstore owners of any kind. If there were any, she certainly didn't know about it. Or that her friends had ever heard of. This bookstore became a gathering place for intellectual conversations. Elizabeth was both the first and the only woman to host a meeting of the Transcendentalist Club with Emerson and others. Margaret Fuller held her conversations for women in the bookstore's back room. Through her bookstore, Elizabeth herself was the author and translator of half a dozen books, founder of her own magazine, contributor to the literary journals of the day. She also became, though, through that bookstore, the publisher of Nathaniel Hawthorne, of William Ellery Channing, of Theodore Parker, of Margaret Fuller, under her own imprint, E.P. Peabody Publisher. Later in life, Elizabeth was inspired by the example she saw when visiting Germany of what were called kindergartens, right? That word kindergarten is a German word. Kinder, children, garten, garden. So children's garden, a garden for children where children could be mothered by teachers. They could be nurtured and inspired. So this was really a revolutionary concept of the time of a formal, nurturing, educational environment for children younger than first grade. And when Elizabeth died in 1894 at the age of 90, of almost 90, she was widely celebrated as the founder of kindergartens in America. I've concentrated almost exclusively on Elizabeth Peabody, but if you explore more about the Peabody sisters, you'll find in addition, and there's an excellent book by Megan Marshall, who wrote an outstanding biography of Margaret Fuller as well, but there's one called The Peabody Sisters, three American women who ignited American Romanticism. So in addition to many other details, if you explore those or other books, you'll find that Mary, the second-born Peabody sister, was an important educator in her own right who also partnered with Elizabeth on many projects. She married the politician and educational reformer Horace Mann. Sophia, the younger sister, was a talented painter. She married Nathaniel Hawthorne, the novelist whose most well-known work is The Scarlet Letter. One brief footnote on that with the web of connections. Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter is very much inspired by the life of Margaret Fuller. So her sort of very radical, independent life, having this child out of wedlock, right, in Europe with her younger, eventually husband, but not when they had a kid together. So as I move toward my conclusion, I'll say again that my goal today has not been to overwhelm you with historical detail and intricacy. My hope is that your takeaway will be, again, that as Unitarian Universalists, we stand on the shoulders of giants who were pathbreakers, and many of them were women. And so on this Mother's Day, what has resonated with you about the life and legacy of the Peabody Sisters? What memories have been stirred up within you of those who in the broadest sense have mothered you or have helped midwife who you have become or are becoming? Or shape the world for the better, and that inspired you. Or perhaps most importantly, following their example, whom do you feel called to mentor, to midwife, or to mother?